The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of January 9th, 2016. On this week's show, we'll talk about the opening weekend of the NFL playoffs, with a particular focus on the New York Giants' party boat and their devotion to bare-chestedness in both warm and cold weather. We'll then discuss ESPN's Chris Berman, who will soon be back, please kill me, gone from our television sets. And the great game of darts will be discussed on this podcast for the first time ever. Darts. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan. Shit, I didn't think of a nickname for you.
No, just Stefan Shit. Let's go for it.
Stefan Shit.
Bullseye.
Fatsis. Man, I can't believe Berman beat me at that ESPN audition. Still bitter about that. The author of the books, Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hi, Josh.
I'm sure you got a lot of cruel nicknames as a child on the playground, so I'm not going to perpetuate
it. Just given your personality.
I'm Minnesota sure. Fatsis.
Oh, that's good.
Isn't that good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stefan Boat Fatsis, just to go with the nautical theme and the theme of my not being able to come up with nicknames on the fly. And with us, as always, from New York, is Mike.
Bed and breakfast. Bag and nails. Baby ton. These are all darts terms. A baby ton is a score of 95. A bed and breakfast is, of course, a 26. Bag and nails, landing all three darts in the ones. Bag and nails. Boom.
You're wasting
boom,
all of our afterball names.
Mike Pesca, the host of Slate's Daily Podcast, The Gist. Hey, Mike.
I like how we've conflated the Berman and the darts, though.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Bag and
nails.
What
we do.
Dark.
We're the conflators. So there's no whimsy watch during the playoffs. I don't know if you guys remember that. It's too serious. There's no time for shenanigans.
I have some Scorigami news, though, which I think qualifies. Quick Scorigami news. There was no Scorigami in the playoffs, but you might recall that John Boyce and I noted in the podcast that Pro Football Reference does not include the 1 point final scores, 6-1, 8-1, 9-1, sure, et cetera. Pro Football Reference has updated its database of missing scores.
Update,
to include 6-1, 8-1, 9-1, et cetera.
Wow.
I messaged with Sean Foreman, the founder of sportsreference.com, and he said, yes, it's because of John Boyce. They fixed the database.
I hope that people who are carving your gravestone have gotten this news.
John Boyce's gravestone.
Some new, or your Hall of Fame plaque, one or the other.
One or the other.
Can you use a Hall of Fame plaque as a gravestone? It seems like a great...
Same shape, right?
Efficiency.
You can use it as a murder weapon.
Why not? Why not all three? In our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, I thought we could talk about our favorite pub games.
Oh.
Maybe I shouldn't be presumptuous. Oh. Maybe Mike Pesca hates all pub games and has just been waiting for this opportunity to tell the world.
I want to give the pub game pub.
There has never been a better time to sign up for Slate Plus. We're offering 30% off an annual membership right now. That's just $35 for a year of Plus, with bonus segments of this and other Slate podcasts every week and a lot more. So if you haven't joined Plus yet, sign up before this offer goes away at slate.com/hangupplus. The four home teams and four favorites, the Texans, Seahawks, Steelers, and Packers, all won on the NFL's wildcard weekend and all by healthy margins. The 19-point average of victory was the biggest on the opening weekend of the NFL playoffs since 1981. The biggest blowout was Green Bay's 38-13 win over the New York Giants at Lambeau Field, a game the Giants led 6-0 until late in the first half when the Packers scored a touchdown, and then Aaron Rodgers hit Randall Cobb with a Hail Mary as time expired in the first half. As the score widened after halftime, the conversation changed to a meta conversation about the conversation about Giants receiver Odell Beckham, who was photographed shirtless on a boat in Miami with a handful of his teammates earlier in the week. Here's Joe Buck and Troy Aikman early in the fourth quarter, in the seconds after a ball caromed off Beckham's fingertips.
There's Beckham, and it's off his hands. And right or wrong, fair or not fair, when you do what Beckham and the receiver crew did on the off day Monday, and that pass was a little too deep for Odell Beckham, but he has not been the typical presence or weapon in this game. People will go back and Well, point out that trip. Those are two drops that he's got in this game, and they're costly. And that ball, I don't know why he jumped. If he runs, he runs right through the catch, and it was a well-thrown ball, and you got to make that play. You don't get more open than that in the NFL. Those are two huge drops by Odell Beckham.
Oh, my God. So much going on in there. You got to make the play.
I had that question because he's in the box score. It says he has three drops. I don't even know if that's in the box score, but that's like an official NFL stat. Mm-hmm. Is the guy who records what is a drop, do they go around the NFL office and is just the guy who says, you got to make that catch the loudest? Is that the official
yes.
the official drop counter?
And that guy's nickname is Skrillex because he records the drops. Boom.
Berman 2.0. So back to the clip. The right or wrong, fair or not fair.
Yeah, right.
From Buck.
Berman's making a Skrillex. Right. Swedish House Mafia reference. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
The right or wrong, fair or not fair from Joe Buck is so great because it's as if there's some immutable law of the universe at work here and nobody has any agency.
People are saying it's very Trumpian.
Just saying. I wrote that down. It is totally Trumpian.
The post-game, it's as if the post-game abandoned ship and shipwrecked headlines mm-hmm. on the covers of the New York tabloids were written by nautical pun-making robots rather than actual humans. Just like, we have no choice. We have to talk about this, Stefan.
You got to say Yatzal, folks, was pretty good, though.
Mm-hmm.
I give credit to the Post, the New York Post, for that. The Daily News fell down on the job a little bit.
Yeah.
Big Blue's party boat hits iceberg in Green Bay for the subhead.
Nobody used Titanic.
Nobody used Mina Kimes' catamarans either, which I think was pretty good.
That's good. Those are your thoughts?
Yeah.
That's all you got?
That's all I've got on the headlines.
Well, continue. What else do you have for us?
On the Joe Buck sanctimony?
Or just on the boat?
The boat.
I think anything on a boat is funny.
Yeah. Das Boot.
A.
Yeah. Mm. Well, particularly because of the Minnesota Vikings party boat.
Sex boat, Stefan.
Sorry.
Use the proper terminology.
Here's what I have to say. In my experience having this conversation with National Football League players, the point that they make over and over again is that their work environment is one of the most repressive and oppressive that we know for people that make a lot of money. Having a day off means having a day off.
It's like being in a mine shaft, essentially.
They can do whatever the fuck they want on their day off. They recognize that people will scrutinize what they do on their day off in situations like this one and criticize them if they fail. But ultimately, they're allowed to get on a plane for 2.5 hours and enjoy a weekend in the sun in the middle of the frigging winter in New Jersey on their day off.
Who would prevent the wide receivers from going on Trey Songz' yacht? We've all done the same. I love the word party used as a verb.
Yeah.
They partied.
Mm-hmm.
They partied with Justin Bieber. They partied on a yacht and were offered Adderall. They partied.
Oh, it is a verb.
I enjoyed Troy Aikman joining in with the consternation,
oh,
the condemnation. Was he not aware that the Dallas Cowboys had the White House in Alvin Harper's name, where several members of the Cowboys would use it to spirit in cocaine and hookers on this cul-de-sac right near Irving, Texas?
I believe the line that Joe Buck threw to Troy Aikman to discuss this was, the game has changed a lot since you played.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Back then. See, but I will say the difference is Michael Irvin held on to the ball. And while it is true.
Justin Bieber wasn't even alive back
Michael
then.
Michael Irvin also held on to a pair of scissors.
Yes. And Alvin Harper held on to the hooters of several hookers. But here's the point. This is why it was an immature decision. Obviously, the only thing, let's say the guy partied on a Monday and he had a bad Tuesday in terms of preparation and where he should be. He was in the right spot. He didn't do anything wrong mentally. There's no 6-day physical holdover that would cause him to drop the ball. It's not like he wasn't on the same game plan. That's the only possible logical point you can make. But the illogical point point is what is known as the anchoring heuristic. When we seek an explanation, the thing that is available, here's another heuristic to us, is that he did this weird thing or this thing out of the ordinary that maybe we wouldn't have done on Monday. And that's why it was, in fact, an immature decision. And I would not have done it because you know you play in New York. I would not have done it because I'm 44 and not Odell Beckham. But because
and you don't know Justin Bieber. Yeah.
And you don't know Trey Songz either.
Yeah. Yeah, and because, you know, I don't have those good hookups with the party boat charter company. But you're going to open yourself up to the criticism. And if you're going to have a press conference where you get all angry and bang your head against the locker, see, the immature thing is not to be able to see scenarios play out two or three moves ahead. So in retrospect, I bet he regrets going on the boat, if not because it affected his play, if only it affected the headache after his play. Take away
I'm
the boat
sure.
scenario, you just say, Odell had a great season, and it sucks that he dropped those balls, but he had such a great season. How do you blame Odell? I mean, it's just an unfortunate thing. With the boat, he becomes a villain. It could color his entire, what should be a love affair between New York and Odell, and that's why he should regret having gone on the boat.
Oh, now you're sounding like the media yourself, Mike, in indicting Odell Beckham. Maybe Odell Beckham and the three other wide receivers didn't care what the reaction would
be. Was Shepard on the phone? He had a really good
lost.
Catch.
Who cares? This is going to end in 2 days. The headlines will go away. They will go to their offseason, which will last about a week.
And Shepard was on the boat. Yes.
Yeah, he was.
Let's listen to the Odell post-game presser here.
This was before or after he punched a hole in the wall.
Unclear.
At the end of the day, I went through practice, had zero drops, zero miss assignments. There was nothing that could connect 7 days ago to today and how we came out and played and executed. There's just nothing in the world that's not realistic. I think it did a great job at creating distractions for us. And it's unfortunate. That's just the way this world is.
I'm a little confused by that last line. It did a great job of creating distractions for us, because then maybe what he's saying is in defense of what you say, Mike, which is that he should have anticipated that it could create distractions and therefore it could affect us, because he's almost implying that it did affect us.
Three-dimensional hot take chess there. You got to. What's the Wayne Gretzky thing? You've got to pass the take to where the take's going to be.
Yeah. And it might only be warm when you pass it. It might heat up upon the passing.
Can we talk about the not wearing sleeves and going out in pregame with no clothing on when it was, 3 degrees outside? Mm-hmm. What's the point? Like, I'm still at a loss for the what is it, a manliness thing? Is it a football code thing? I still don't understand the not wearing sleeves. I mean, if you feel like it impacts your ability to move and catch the ball, I understand. Any other reason, I don't get it.
I mean, it's just obviously a stupid macho thing, and it's like a performative way whereby you show the other team and the world that you're not affected by this thing that you're clearly affected by. So if we're going to say that Beckham doesn't care what people think, that seems to be extremely far from the truth. Like, the way in which he behaves kind of constantly, he seems extraordinarily aware of whether it's like proposing to the kicking net after he punched it. basically everything that he does on the field and off, it seems like he knows that he's being watched and that he's being scrutinized, and going out and catching balls before the game starts
shirtless.
Without a shirt and without pants on. Don't forget, your legs can get cold too. That's obviously designed to have people like look at how tough he is. And if he had a really good game, it would have burnished the legend of Odell Beckham that he had gone on this boat, that he sloughed off the haters, and that he caught, you know, 8 balls for 150 yards and
naked.
2 touchdowns.
Naked.
Totally buck-ass naked on the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. And he has accrued so much fame from being in New York and from making one-hand catches and from, you know, having cool hair. And he will accrue a lot of fame and a lot of, positive coverage the next time he does something great.
Which he will.
And this is the opposite of that.
And so what?
Can you imagine the boat-related touchdown celebrations that will occur? The nautical, the rowing, the port and starboard side, the land ho. We're going to get all
fishing?
Of them.
Did they do fishing? They can reel in a marlin.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
why did the Giants lose, though? The Giants had an opportunity to be leading by more than 6-0. And their play calling and their decision making was predictably, and to Troy Aikman's viewpoint, appropriately conservative. They had a chance to go for it on 4th-and-3 from the Packers' 35-yard line. They punted, pinned them back, but still, they had a chance to go for it on 4th-and-3 from the Packers' 8-yard line, and they chose to kick a field goal. So, you know.
Oh, no, Beckham also dropped a pass in the end zone.
Yeah.
And oh, yeah, I forgot.
I noted
No,
this.
He did.
No, I know he did.
He did.
I know he did.
Don't roll.
I know he did.
That's not an eye-rolling moment. Well, he did drop a pass in the end zone.
He dropped a pass in the end zone, but they had other opportunities to try to get into the end.
Okay, now this is the interesting thing. Their loss was, and I think we as humans have a hard time with this, their loss was overdetermined. It had many mothers. And it's exactly like the election, where you could say that Hillary Clinton lost, and you could say, no, she lost because she said the deplorables. If she hadn't said the deplorables, would she have lost? In fact, this game
she lost because of Meryl Streep's speech.
This game is extremely like the election. Hillary mm-hmm. was the Giants. One, they're New York based. Mm-hmm. Two, they took Wisconsin for granted. They didn't compete hard in Wisconsin. Three, mm-hmm. early on, it looked like the Giants would be able to neutralize the whites, i.e. Jordy. But he didn't because the whites roared back, i.e. Clay. The diverse coalition is represented by the Giants receiving corps, Victor Cruz and so forth, not mm-hmm. as robust as the Packers' mostly white lineup. In fact, 4/5 of their line, white guys. The vaunted blue wall crumbled, the ground game was off, and the Packers seemed to have the Giants' playbook, I suspect the Russians.
Also, they kind of look like they were wearing pantsuits because they had the white uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys hear the kind of narrative wheels grinding when the Packers went for it on 4th down? They got stuffed. The Giants immediately went down and scored to cut it to 14-13. And Troy Aikman was like, they shouldn't have gone for it there. You can't really go for it there. Momentum. And then as soon as the Packers go down and score immediately, then they start talking about, oh, you could go for it there because you have Aaron Rodgers.
Ah.
It was unreal. It was unreal. And then
the take should have then been to be consistent. If you go for it, you can't take the ball out of Aaron Rodgers' hands.
And then as soon as the score gets out of hand, then you can, once it's like overdetermined, once there are so many different reasons that the game has been lost, you can just focus on the most entertaining reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So where does this rank in the all-time list of going somewhere you're not supposed to go before a playoff game? There's Vince Carter, Eastern Conference semifinals, 2001.
Graduating from college?
Before game 7, he's having this great series, this duel with Allen Iverson. He flies to his graduation at UNC, comes back, misses a shot with a couple seconds to go to have his team lose the playoff series. That to me is an all-timer.
Should it's, not have graduated I think, from college.
I think that one's number one on the list.
Yeah.
The thing that I only realized when I went back and looked at this this morning, and I don't know if anyone's actually commented on this, Vince Carter got his degree in African American studies from North Carolina.
No. Oh, God.
And the scandal around the African American Studies Department at UNC goes back to 1997. So this is not something that happened after Vince Carter left. Kind of changes the whole valence of the Vince Carter graduation conversation. The other all-time great is Michael Jordan going to the casino in Atlantic City.
Yeah.
During the Eastern Conference Finals in 1993, they won that series because it was the Bulls and Michael Jordan. The last championship in their first three-peat. But in that game, game 2 in Madison Square Garden, the next day, and he had reportedly been out to 2:30 in the morning, but he disputed it and said he was in bed by 1 a.m. Anyway, the next game they lost and Jordan shot 12 for 32.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
How did he do in the casino?
He, unclear. I don't know.
Well, I would say the two big ones are Eugene Robinson going to the hooker before the Super Bowl, and tragically, not to make fun of Barrett Robbins, going kind of insane and going to Mexico before the Super Bowl. And then I guess anything that, like Charles Barkley said before a finals, he went there.
But I just don't know, what is the statute of limitations here? Because it was...
There is none. It's a take.
But the statute until you actually win a championship, right? To make up.
No, but all of the ones that we just mentioned are like the day before.
Right.
Where it seems... It a actually week? Does seem...
On your day off, doing nothing wrong? Yeah.
It does seem legitimate, the casino one. But that's the thing. It's like if somebody happens to post it to Instagram or somebody sees you in a casino... I think it was on a Zach Lowe podcast, or I was listening to this the last couple of weeks, that this is something that teams are actually concerned about, and it doesn't usually get out. That there are like lots of guys, he was talking about in the NBA specifically, that are just like going out and quote unquote partying a lot, like during, like right before a game.
Yeah.
And there are jokes about like, oh, you're, you know, the day game in Miami. On Sunday, the like visiting team is going to lose and all that stuff. But if it's like fucking 7 days before, that seems
right. In the most restrictive relevant. Sport. I mean, there is very little room for these guys to A, release some tension from playing this game, or B, doing stuff without being noticed by management and reprimanded by management.
It should be noted that Connor Cook got a lot of sleep the day before he sucked against the Texans.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Last week, ESPN announced that Chris Berman was rumbling, bumbling, stumbling, frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. Eric sleeping with Bieniemy. Whoop, whoop, whoop,
whoop, whoop.
Sorry, can you kick me? My circuits got a little scrambled there. I don't know what happened. Blacked out for a second. Last week, ESPN announced that Chris Berman was stepping down after 31 years as the host of the cable network's NFL studio shows, though he will retain a limited role offering opinion and perspective on historical events in the NFL. Berman is probably the voice most associated with ESPN. He was one of the original hosts of SportsCenter, as well as the highlight show NFL Primetime, and he brought his trademark annoying shtick to such events as the NFL Draft and Major League Baseball's Home Run Derby. In a celebratory interview with Scott Van Pelt on SportsCenter last week, Berman said that when he came into the office that day, he played the songs Take It to the Limit, Rocket Man, and The Last Resort, the last song on the Eagles' Hotel California record, which then led into a long lyrical analysis that I did not listen to. I grew up watching Chris Berman. I have a lot of residual affection and nostalgia for NFL Primetime, which we can get into in a bit. But I find him insufferable, is I think the right word. What do you think, Mike?
First of all, you know what's fascinating? LeBron James is closer in age to Steph Curry than Chris Berman is to Skip Bayless. I don't know why Skip Bayless is the mark of youth, but Chris Berman's 4 years younger than Skip Bayless. He just seems, you know, kind of ancient. I'm fortunate because I was in college and we played this drinking game and there were a lot of Chris Berman catchphrases involved. So this at least gives me a signpost that when I was 21, if it was a drinking game, I thought he was kind of funny, right? I liked the nicknames. There was a time when we all liked the nicknames. Mm-hmm. And then the internet, especially Deadspin, really piled on Berman, who to me was just like, what did he do? He was a sideshow guy who gave you some nicknames and tried to make highlights fun. This isn't a very important job. It was revealed, especially in Those Guys Have All the Fun, the ESPN book, that he thinks his highlight show made the NFL, which is crazy out of control ego. So the Berman pendulum has certainly swung like Tommy James and the Shondells, or the Swinging Medallions, who, of course, wait, what was their song? There's from South Carolina. They did na 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 na. The Rock and the Monia. I'm going to get the Swinging Medallions song. Anyway, yeah, we've probably given him too much flack, but overall, he is just a somewhat annoying showman who did highlights okay.
Chris Berman, though, and ESPN were unable to recognize what had happened in the internet era, that he had overstayed his welcome as a shtick provider. He is listed, by the way, on the Wikipedia entry for shtick, among other shtick purveyors, but right between Johnny Carson and George Carlin, which actually probably gives Chris Berman a little bit too much credit. So the inability to adapt to the times is where Chris Berman is a complete annoyance and ESPN is a total failure. I mean, he is another example of someone who was enabled for decades, started off fine, then because of whatever power within the company, whatever alliances he had forged with the company, he was allowed to stay on despite him being undermined, criticized, exposed as a fraud and a petulant asshole in the booth very often in the studio.
What do you mean by fraud?
That he pretended to be something that he wasn't, that he was sort of an icon of sports and that what he was doing was important to the future of sports. Don't call me a sports personality, he said to one interviewer at one point. I mean, Chris Berman made himself bigger than anything he talked about and proudly was a shill for the NFL and had no qualms with that. And ESPN went along with that, as ESPN has done in certain situations.
I think you guys are dating the point at which he became dated incorrectly. I think it was when Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick took over the...
Smarter, funnier.
Right, and just more modern. It was like...
Yeah, except they were doing SportsCenter when I was in college, and it was great. I mean, they started doing it, and we still thought Chris Berman was funny. So it happened around that time.
There was some overlap, but certainly Berman was usurped because other people were more intelligent and were remaking this medium.
Well, Olbermann and Patrick were like Letterman, and he was like Leno. Like, he is like the Jay Leno of sports television. It's just like, you know, one-liners. It's very old-fashioned and shticky.
References are all dated.
Lance, you've sunk my blankenship. So I've got a clip. There's some music in the background because this was a 20th anniversary ESPN package where he talks about how he came up with the nickname thing. Let's listen to that.
The ultimate frisbee. John Pythagoras theory. Eric sleeping with the enemy. Chris Calloway.
It has evolved into something else totally, a whole language within itself.
Now, June 1980, one of them came out by accident. Could have been Frank Sinatra Daiquiri or John Mayberry RFD. And everyone, the camera started shaking. The producer talked in my ear and said, what are you doing?
I don't have one yet.
And now, if a player doesn't have a nickname, they get upset.
I love the self-serious linguistic, academic deconstruction of what he does.
But the way he says, it could have been Frank Tanana Daiquiri. It could have been John Mayberry RFD.
But can I – when Stuart Scott died, I mean, it was tragic that he died, but he was lauded and we had his contemporaries on the show to talk about the importance. What did he do? He, from his purview and perspective and milieu, larded highlights with catchphrases. I mean, how was that so different? It would have been nice if Berman had tried to, you know, reference a song recorded past 1987. Fine, but he didn't. To me, I thought the title of that ESPN book, Those Guys Had All the Fun, was weird, and I never thought of ESPN like that. But apparently a lot of people do. A lot of people thought that it was just, you know, a fun house, and he was the chief clown. And so I think we in the media who do things a little bit differently denigrate what he does, which is a showman for the masses. And even though he had an outsized ego and had an inflated sense of his importance with the sport itself, he was a fine entertainer who didn't deserve the millions he made, but probably deserved some portion thereof. Double shot of my baby's love, by the way, was the Swing of the Medallion song.
Here's the difference. Stuart Scott was told repeatedly at ESPN and before he got to ESPN that he couldn't talk the way that he talked because he was not speaking in a way that you could speak on TV because he was too black and that he was talking too black and that there weren't people that sounded like Stuart Scott sounded. And so even if you found, and I will not, you know, I will say it myself, even if I found Stuart Scott to be annoying sometimes, he was still important, and a lot of people felt like they were seeing themselves on TV for the first time and felt like heard and understood and represented by him. And so he was important in that regard. Chris Berman is like, there are lots of people like Chris Berman on television. The fact that there is not a sitcom on CBS about Chris Berman's life, I think, is the greatest upset of our age. He represents what TV executives think people want to see, which is like a white dude referencing classic rock. And the fact that ESPN, as Stefan said, didn't recognize that he was outdated and that maybe somebody else should be the face of the network seems like a big error.
But wait, I have to push. Can I just push back on that? I'll give you the racial component. But there was a time when Chris Berman was rebellious, not equally rebellious, and the stakes weren't as high. But it's exactly like when we look back at those, you know, Harold Ramis or Animal House comedies, and they seem very masculine and very white and out of step with and pretty safe because it was just whatever, the patriarchy and all that. But Berman was a break from, he was a reverence, you know, and he was a break from the reverence of sports casting.
I don't disagree with you. And I should have acknowledged that.
It did get old and tired, and it was a shame that it was never updated, but there was some innovation. And he even was talking in that clip that the players thought of it as an insult and then they came to like it. And I think we've just priced in that irreverence. And for the last 20 years, it wasn't updated, but at a time, not Stuart Scott-esque, the stakes weren't as high, but he was still representing a break from tradition. And so was Leno, by the way. The analogy is good.
My point is just that it got really old fast.
Yeah. And that this multi-billion dollar network chose to allow it to continue. And not only that, what Berman also came to represent about the relationship between the network and the NFL did damage to ESPN. Richard Deitch pointed this out in a piece over the weekend. Berman ultimately chose the path of being NFL PR over sports journalism. It made him rich and famous, but also a delivery clerk, bringing Paul Tagliabue and Roger Goodell's messages up the river and into your living room. And the desire not to do anything remotely journalistic. And I think Berman would say, I'm not a journalist, but I'm not a sports personality either. So what am I? I'm an entertainer? Well, guess what, ESPN? You're not entirely in the entertainment business, because you are in bed with the NFL and you have people like Chris Berman carrying the NFL's water. As he once said, I'm a simple guy. I don't watch TV. I don't go on the internet. So I never watched Playmakers, the show that the NFL forced ESPN to cancel about the inner life of a professional football league. But I knew if the league was pissed, I should probably be pissed. ESPN could have gotten away from that taint a lot sooner than it did, if it ever did.
There are a couple of things that I want to say. Number one is Bobby bad to the Bonilla. Number two is, yeah, I mean, there are two entirely separate reasons to criticize him. And for whatever reason, just him being annoying bothers me more because I just feel like, you know, he's an NFL shill. That is objectively worse than him, you know, describing a big hit as a
Bad Moon Rising.
or him describing a big hit in the Monday Night Football game as a rack and pinion hit because the 49ers punter is Bradley Pinion, as Awful Announcing noted. But you know what? I can't, what can I tell you? I just find the rack and pinion thing more annoying than being a shill for the NFL. And the fact that he was getting the like Monday Night Football gig and that
and was really bad at it and was allowed to do golf, which he was even worse at.
Allowed to do golf. Fuck you, man. Who cares? Who cares about golf? I'm fine with him ruining golf. But like the Home Run Derby and the NFL Draft, the point is just that every event that ESPN invested with importance, like he was the guy that they put out there. And it just seemed unearned by the end. Or, you know, like it was based on his accomplishments from the 80s. And
it
I did want to
based on Hideo ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no mo.
My last point is I promised to say something about NFL primetime. And my early sports watching Chris Berman experience was in the 80s when NFL primetime was the only place where you could see highlights of all the games. And ESPN, I think, paid good money to get that rights deal from the NFL. And so I would watch it every week. I would want to see the Saints highlights. And I can remember feeling like as a kid that, you know, when the Saints won, I really wanted to see what Chris Berman and Tom Jackson said. It like felt like a big deal, just like it was a big deal when John Madden and Pat Summerall called the game. And they did like these long extended clips, and you got to actually see like the line play and the most important thing from the game, the things that you wouldn't necessarily see in the highlights. And it was like a cool and important show, and he was the head of it. And so that is my like positive, happy Chris Berman memory.
Mm-hmm. And the E in ESPN stands for what Chris Berman embodied.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But can you ever forgive?
He did Todd really good.
Highway to Helton.
The Swami did really good against the spread this year. Did you know that? Really good.
I thought the E in ESPN stood for Tom East of Edens. Or no, wait. It actually stood for Joey Betty Davis Eichen.
Is there someone doing...
Betty Davis Eichen. All right, we got it.
Eddie, eat, drink, and be Murray.
We got to get out of this segment before it consumes us all.
The Seahawks with the uncalled "I can't feel my face mask" penalty. I just want some. I just want some updates on the Berman.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
For the world title.
20. The bullseye! And Michael Baskerwin has waited 3 long years for that magical moment to be crowned King of Darts again. He owns every big title in the world of darts, but that was the one he wanted, the one he craved, the one he needed above all others, and he's got it. For the second time, Michael Baskerwin earns the right to say, "I am the world champion."
What we just heard is darts, and what a darts it was. A week ago at Alexandra Palace in North London, the best darts player in the world became the darts champion of the world as Michael Van Gerwen defeated Gary Anderson 7-3 to reclaim the title he lost 2 years earlier. As Andrew Kay wrote in a great piece for the New York Times, Van Gerwen is by far and away the best player in the world, the Michael Jordan of darts, in Kay's words. But all the darts wags were raising questions about if the 27-year-old Dutchman could dart it up when the darts darted most. And dart he did, losing just 9 sets in 7 matches. We just heard a bit of the atmosphere of the World Championships. And I got, once I kind of figured out that we probably should talk about darts, once that became clear, I got really into watching darts videos on YouTube, and darts is great. Darts is really, really amazing. The atmosphere at the darts place, the crowd, the pace of the game is incredible. I love darts.
The body types.
Yeah,
there's no barrier in darts. The humblest young man or woman, boy or girl, can grow up to be a Michael Van Gerwen.
Has like a 6-year-old ever won the darts world championship? It seems possible.
Seems plausible. Yeah. Maybe like a 17-year-old.
Maybe Velcro. Those Velcro ball darts for safety's sake.
Yeah, you don't want to start with the real darts.
Did you have the Velcro ball darts?
No, we had real darts.
Yeah, but when I was young, we went Velcro.
No, we didn't have Velcro.
Yeah.
You were soft, Mike.
That's right.
Yeah, seriously, Pesca. All right, let's talk about darts, though. Darts is
that's the plan.
That is the plan, but we've digressed into Velcro. I like the darts. I never had, I confess, I had never examined the rules of darts or the way darts are played. So it starts with each player has 501 points to start, and you got to get down to exactly zero. And there are different scoring things.
There's a dart board
on the board.
Throw the dart at the board.
At the board, and where it lands within each numbered triangle cone shaped thing determines whether you get that number, double it, triple it. The bullseye is 50.
There's a quote unquote bullseye.
The bullseye.
In the middle.
50 points.
Yeah. So
it's super strategic.
This is good. This is helpful. Now I'm getting into it.
Yeah.
I wonder
what if the dart hangs and then falls? How long does it have to hang?
That's a great question. Yeah. So we often have an expert on the show just to answer questions like this, but you know, we're just gonna
We're winging it.
We're gonna go after this ourselves. I wonder whether you have to be good at math to be good at darts.
Yes.
They throw the darts very quickly. It's like triple 20. Okay, that's a 60.
I'm down to 170. Right. What do I have to do to go out?
I would guess that it's actually just like a spatial thing where you know where you need to throw, that they're actually not counting in their heads, like, okay, I've got to throw a 17 now. Where's the 17? It's like, if you dart enough, you're going to know where on the board you need to throw.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's sort of the dirty little secret of darts is that it's a math game that you have to combine those two skills. You got to be good at math and good at darting.
And yeah. Good at subtracting.
Good at subtracting.
The answer is it's exactly like poker, which is when you're young, right. Knowing a little bit about or knowing a lot about math helps. But once we're watching, you and I, or the people paying 25 quid to go to a tournament where the drinks flow, they have it, like there's no question that someone's going to make a math mistake. They've done this so often, mm-hmm. They know every permutation, and it doesn't really become, there's only so many situations to be in, and it doesn't really become about thinking in the moment. But, you know, when you're young, you kind of have to do some calculation. But by the main stage, there are very few mental mistakes. Cut to some darts experts going, I know, remember in 1989 when he got the prime numbers.
So Van Gerwen is a really fascinating guy. He does not practice. He won every major tournament this year. And it is just incredibly comforting to know that the darts media and the darts takes are exactly like the takes in every other sport. It's like if he didn't win this world championship, he was going to be a total failure and like the worst human that ever lived. He's like won the most – he has like the most amazing record, you know, best year ever. He's won all this prize money.
But he'll never be the Jack Nicklaus of darts because
– the Phil Taylor of darts.
The yeah. Phil Taylor of darts, yes. 16 world championships at a time when – you know, nobody was darting.
Yeah, yeah.
And not at this level.
Right.
I mean,
not during the darts golden age that we're experiencing
right. He was competing against people who actually practiced. He didn't have to compete against like some Michael Van Gerwen who never practices. But
he does go to the pub and throw darts, but that's not practicing.
I learned a few things about darts by Googling. Here's some things I learned. Players have walk-up music in darts. Jamie Lewis, for instance, his nickname is The Rasta. And his walk-on music is Bruno Mars's Uptown Funk.
Uh-huh.
I don't know when they play the walk-up. Here's a big, fat old guy. Let's see what his walk-up music is. The Trashmen, Surfin' Bird.
This is so
Even
funny.
Bunting.
All the music that you've referenced, including just hearing Seven Nation Army, it's all American music. So we are – our culture is influencing dark culture one way or another.
So Sky Sports had a recap that I enjoyed every magical moment from the 2017 PDC World Darts Championship. And this recap of the opening day is just fantastic. The curtain raiser saw reigning world darts champion Gary Anderson record a comfortable opening night victory over Mark Frosty the Throwman Frost.
Frosty the Throwman!
Did you make that up? Was that Berman-esque? Or is that in the story?
It's in the copy. Well, there were also wins for Kevin Painter, Michael Smith, and Jamie Lewis. World Youth Champion Smith won a 5-set thriller against Rapid Ricky Evans, who threw a maximum in record quick time. Then there's this gif underneath the write-up where it throws this guy throwing three darts in 2.16 seconds, perfect 180, fastest ever. I mentioned the pace of the game earlier. Mm-hmm. There's all this consternation and teeth gnashing about, will people want to sit and watch a 3.5 hour college football game or a, you know, 3 hour NBA game or a long ass baseball game? Darts seems to be perfectly calibrated and attuned to, you know, the appetites of the viewing public. It is totally raucous atmosphere. People are throwing darts in 2.16 seconds. There's loud music. There's drinking. There's a PA announcer who says, 180. What else could you ask for in a sport?
I feel they wear bowling shirts with logos on them.
No, bowlers wear dart shirts.
Good point.
And there's all this money in the sport. I think increasing interest in watching it on television for darts.
You know who I hate
the darts,
now?
The darts people need to take over all sports.
Brendan Dolan, the history maker. His walk-on music is the Dropkick Murphys.
Ugh, I'm shipping up to another Boston. U.S. band. It's unbelievable.
Right. Yeah. Another feature of darts. Here are the attire rules. Players are not permitted to wear jeans. Neither shall they wear trousers or skirts made with denim or corduroy material, which have been fashioned in a jeans style.
So that's nice for not only a restriction, but a good definition of anything that could be constituted as jeans.
No training shoes will be allowed unless the player provides written medical reasons from a qualified practitioner. The restriction shall also apply to any form of tracksuit attire.
Oh, wow. I've got to change my tune on this sport.
I know. A little bit restrictive. And there is drug testing in darts, by the way. And there is a disciplinary committee for the World Darts Organization, whatever it's called. And
I hope it's DART. I hope the World Darts Organization is DART and somehow you've retrofitted the acronym. And I hope the D in DART isn't darts, because I don't like that. I'll allow it to have darts. But anyway, I'm going to work on
it. I like Van Gerwen, though. He's got a firm stand. He's a millionaire. His life has changed because of darts. But he wants more drug testing in the sport. He thinks there is a potential there, problematic. Darts, bridge, they've all have their drug issues. And the issue in darts, frankly, is a real one, beta blockers. It's sort of like shooting or biathlon in the Olympics, anything that'll bring down your heart rate and focus you in.
There is a thing called dartitis, where you lose the ability to throw the darts.
The sort Chuck Knobloch of darts.
That would be a good darts name.
I was going to say the Steve Sachs disease of darts, but mm-hmm. Chuck Knobloch works too.
Yeah.
But Van Gerwen is, by all accounts, the greatest darts player in history. And this final match where he beat Gary Anderson, the defending champion, it had an all-time record with 42 maximums mm-hmm. combined for the players. That's when you get the maximum possible total. That's when you – I don't know if it has to be a 180, but a 180 is when you hit the triple 20 three times in a row. I would guess that a maximum is just when – If you want to get a triple 19.
And the triple 20 is the little sliver on the outer ring.
Yeah.
Right.
But 42 maximums, beating the
there was
previous
some quality,
world record.
Quality of, darts being
beating
thrown.
Beating the previous world record of 34.
Disciplinary proceedings. There were some good ones in 2015. Aaron Monk was suspended for 3 months for reckless throwing of darts. Nikolai McCollin.
Wait a second. He threw darts at people? You can't do that.
It didn't say that he threw them at people. He may have thrown them to the ground in anger or frustration, which seems to be a no-no. Nikolai McCollin, shouting, removing shirt, and running around at conclusion of match. He was sanctioned for that. Mervyn King, swearing at a woman during an event. Kevin Thomas.
Is there a different penalty for swearing at a man?
Bringing alcohol into venue and drinking in changing rooms. They are firm in their disciplinary proceedings at the Darts Federation. Michael Van Gerwen was sanctioned for swearing on live TV, though I think he wasn't punished because the DVD was inconclusive.
Fascinating. All right.
He's your champion. Stop swearing, Michael.
The DVD.
It says NFA DVD inconclusive.
We've solved a lot here. Still some remaining mysteries. I encourage darts experts to take to our Facebook page mm-hmm. and correct our 5,000 errors. Facebook.com/hangupandlisten.
slash darts.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Stefan, you did a lot of darts terminological research. You have a darts afterball name for us.
I kind of like Oki, though. That was a quickie. Mike, you might have something better. The Oki is the throw line, also known as the toe line.
Ooh. Can't go over that line.
Can't go over the line. For steel tip darts, according to Wikipedia, it is generally 7 feet, 9.25 inches from the face of the dartboard, measured horizontally.
Here's a question I've always had and didn't bother to look up.
Spelled O-C-H-E.
If you have like super long arms, if you have like an NBA like wingspan, would that give you a big advantage in darts, or are you not actually allowed to just – does that not confer an advantage to just reach out really far?
Can't answer that. Mike?
Mike would know. Mike looks like a guy who would know.
This is why Randy Johnson also could have been the greatest darts thrower ever, or as we call it, dartser, dartsier.
Yeah, if you had to hit the dart,
yeah,
Randy Johnson would have had a huge advantage.
Mike, what is your Oki?
So last night at the Golden Globes, Meryl Streep once again demonstrated her versatility, this time playing the role of provocateur. For not only did she laud those in her profession, she took dead aim and delivered a rear naked choke to those who pursue another. Here, let's listen.
Ryan Gosling, like all the nicest people, is Canadian. And Dev Patel was born in Kenya, raised in London, and is here for playing an Indian raised in Tasmania. So Hollywood is crawling with outsiders and foreigners. And if we kick them all out, you'll have nothing to watch but football and mixed martial arts, which are not the arts.
So why? Why that gratuitous takedown of the MMA? I would just rebut, I understand her point. It is a better world with artists, and let's not be mean to foreigners. But in defense of the mixed martial arts, one, they are arts. I'm sure Meryl Streep, in her training, got trained in the combat arts and stage fighting. That's a part of mixed martial arts. And if you go back in the history, forget what they call mixed martial arts now, but martial arts have as many arts components as they do of hurting the other guy components. Maybe not how it's played now. And I would reckon that if you looked at the pottery, let's say, of antiquity, you'd have more martial arts represented than you would even have thespianism. And the Greeks were adept at both. I just think that, you know, it's easier to have an urn with a guy kicking someone else than some guy talking about frogs on a stage. Aristophanes, shout out. All right, so the other thing about Meryl Streep talking about, you know, if we take out all the foreigners, we're only going to have mixed martial arts. Like, mixed martial arts is mostly made up of foreigners. I don't know if you've watched the MMA lately. I doubt that Meryl Streep has, but it is a melting pot. It is polyglot. Yeah, Dana White did endorse Donald Trump. And I was thinking maybe Meryl Streep could get sucked into the mixed martial arts with just a little rebranding. For instance, she made Sophie's Choice. Maybe she be interested to find out about Sophie's Choice, Gracie, or maybe some martial artists. This is my plan. So there are some martial artists who already have nicknames.
If only Chris Berman had been calling MMA highlights back in his day.
Or, you know, perhaps the Chuck Liddell Wears Prada. All right, here we go. That's not my real plan. My real plan is to convince some mixed martial artists to adopt nicknames, because they all have nicknames and they all have tattoos, maybe tattoos of movie posters of the French lieutenant's woman. That could work. There is already, I found out, there is a female mixed martial artist named, I think, Germaine de Randemir. I'm probably pronouncing it incorrectly, but she fights under the sobriquet the Iron Lady. And Meryl Streep played the Iron Lady. But what about, you know, here are some other mixed martial artists that if they were to just change their nicknames, maybe they would suck in Meryl Streep. Charles Brown, He's known as Dingo Brown. It wouldn't be too many steps for him to change his name to The Dingo Got My Baby Brown. She, of course, gave that line in A Cry in the Dark. And then there's Marvin Eastman, who goes by, and this is a good nickname, Marvin the Beast Man Eastman. But he could very easily be Marvin's Room Eastman, right? That deserved that. And then there's Brian Foster. And just, you know, during this Oscar season, couldn't he rebrand himself Brian Foster Florence Jenkins? This is all I'm saying. If we get Meryl Streep on board, I think martial arts and the thespianic arts could come together in a glorious moment.
You didn't mention her broadside against football.
Oh, yeah. Well, that
Who will stand in defense of the great sport of football from this vicious attack?
Yeah, I mean, I think some football names we could maybe entice her to watch football if there was a guy named Teddy Bridgewaters of Madison County out there, or if Charles Silkwoodson were to patrol the backfield, you know, maybe postcards from an edge rusher. How about Craig Ironweed Hayward or Brian Hart Lineburn, or of course the Deer Hunter Henry. Tommy Kramer versus Tommy Kramer, dear, or defending your Mike Tice. That's
the seduction of Joe Pizarcik.
Yeah.
Stefan, what is your Okie?
As I've mentioned, I'm writing a book about the dictionary. So last week I attended the annual conference of the American Dialect Society, of which I am a dues-paying member, which means I was able, with about 300 linguists, to vote on the group's 2016 Word of the Year. The winner, by a vote of raised hands, was dumpster fire in lexical and emoji form. And the metaphorical use of dumpster fire is about a decade old, and it has sports roots. In a good piece for the Huffington Post last June, Claire Fallon credited Sports Talk Radio, and specifically Colin Cowherd, who was quoted in a couple of blog posts in 2008 using the term dumpster fire. Now, that seems plausible because all of the early print metaphorical usage of dumpster fire is from sports. The first I was able to locate was Patrick Obley writing in the State newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina in 2006. Tank Johnson's life is a dumpster fire, he wrote. 2 years later, Bob Kravitz of the Indianapolis Star wrote, look at the dumpster fire down in Jacksonville, where emotional Jack Del Rio has players going south on him. The first non-sports usage I found is from 2009, and dumpster fire took off from there. After the Dialect Society vote, I was talking to the guy who nominated Dumpster Fire, Dan Villarreal. He's a linguistics postdoc at the University of Nevada, Reno, who, more important, is a listener of this podcast. And we noted that while the Dialect Society voted on several categories, the political word of the year was post-truth over deplorables, slang word of the year was woke, euphemism of the year was locker room banter in an upset over alt-right and fake news, digital word of the year was the at symbol used as a verb, as in don't at me, which defeated my nominee, TweetStorm. So while all that happened, it was the show's duty, our solemn duty here, to crown a sports word of the year. I put together my own list of candidates, put out a call to listeners on the Facebook page. Josh, Mike, and I are going to go through this now. Maybe we'll get to a finalists and we can vote, or we can pick one.
And can I just say that TweetStorm is so much better than the at symbol? Like, so much. It's almost like these people don't understand the internet. I got 16 tweets in a row to explain.
All right, here we go. My starter list for sports word of the year: Go Cubs Go, the lyrics to that song, Fly the W, the Cubs flag thing, 5,000 to 1, Leicester City, Deflategate, old, you can throw it out, but I wanted to mention it. Take a Knee, Colin Kaepernick, of course. Paul Edmonds on Facebook suggested Just Protest, which I like, I think, more than Take a Knee. GOAT, greatest of all time, Ali. Baseball author and Scrabble champion Peter Morris on Facebook nominated Just Greatest. George McGowan on Facebook nominated Ali. I think GOAT is good. It was coined by Ali's people. They created a company, Greatest of All Time, GOAT Inc. It was later changed to Muhammad Ali Enterprises, but that's the derivation of that word. Couldn't really find anything good from the Olympics. Russian doping, maybe. I was like, whatever, Ryan Lochte. Responding to the fake robbers. Josh nominated the Warriors blew a 3-1 lead in the finals. Now, I would say, Josh, this is a sentence of the year, maybe. So as commissioner of sports word of the year, I'm going to cut it to three to one.
The thing that you're not considering, though, is that the Warriors blew a 3-1 lead in the finals.
Yeah. I think 3-1 encapsulates that. Todd Johnson also suggested 3-1 on the Facebook page. A couple more Facebook nominations. Jason Shin, Stick to Sports. Seth Grossman, Football Maneuver. Brian O'Gross, Believe Land for the Cavs and kind of the Indians. A little bit slogan-y, I think. Andre Berman, Take. Adam Hirsch, Hot Take. I just defined Hot Take for Merriam-Webster, so Hot Take will make the final list, I think. Alex Noble nominated Trust the Process. Sam Hinkie, Philadelphia 76ers. That's pretty good. And Andy Noble. Andy is Alex's father. I've sleuthed on Facebook. Andy is a deputy sports editor at the Baltimore Sun. He linked to a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette column by Gene Collier, who does an annual list of sports cliches. Collier's winner was In the Protocol, which is pretty good, actually.
Ooh, I like that. In the Protocol.
You like that?
Yeah, just most of these are things that happen, but I don't think they would satisfy the lexicographer's task, which is to, you know, put your finger on the word that either was popularized or gained widespread acceptance or somehow describes everything.
Like a classic one of these is football move, right?
Right. Football maneuver, somebody nominated on Facebook.
Take or hot take, that's a couple years old, I think. How about second chances?
Why?
Well, all these terrible football players who beat people up, and then we're told, I believe
it's got to be something distinctly 2016, though, which is why it's tricky. You got to merge the lexicographical emergence of a word or term or symbol.
I think In the Protocol is the best one.
Yeah. You like In the Protocol?
Yeah.
All right, we'll put In the Protocol in our finals. Here's my finalists. I would say, how do we feel about it? I think you got a nod to the Cubs, Fly the W, better than Go Cubs Go.
It just wasn't so ubiquitous.
Okay, scratched. Yeah. 5,000-1.
Leicester City.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Too English.
Yeah.
That's okay. Can make the finals. Doesn't mean it's got to win. 3-1. Josh, I'm sorry. You can't do a sentence. I liked Protest, though. I think it was
language
very simple.
Language evolves, Stefan. Sentences are the new words.
Sentences are the new emojis. Protest, very simple. Greatest, I also like. And Goat, I liked In the Protocol. I think we should choose from those, or should we let the people choose?
Up to you.
I'm the commissioner.
You are.
All right. You got a vote?
I say In the Protocol.
In the Protocol. Pesca?
Yeah. I like that. It jumped out. That was my blink reaction.
In the Protocol. I would go with Protest, but I'm outnumbered. So congratulations to In the Protocol, your 2016 Sports Word of the Year. Thanks to Pittsburgh Post-Gazette columnist Gene Collier for choosing it. Clearly the people's choice. Thanks to Andy Noble of the Baltimore Sun for nominating. Thanks to Alex Noble for also nominating. Thanks to all the Nobles, entire Noble family for nominating, for listening, for playing along In the Protocol. Josh, what's your Oki?
So there's been some talk on the internet about the Baseball Hall of Fame, my favorite conversation topic. Who's on the ballot? Who's going to get in? Who's going to fall off? And Jeff Bagwell, Tim Raines, Trevor Hoffman, these are your leading contenders. A lot of animated chatter about Edgar Martinez, Curt Schilling. What about Curt Schilling in the character clause? You've got your Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens still hanging around. And then, you know, your fringy candidates, your Billy Wagners, your Jeff Kents. Then there are these guys. If you play in the major leagues for 10 years and you're retired for 5, the kind of gold watch that you get is you get to be on the Hall of Fame ballot. That's the honor. It's an honor just to be nominated. That's what I believe. So Matt Stairs, congratulations for being on the Hall of Fame ballot. You did it, man. Congratulations.
Professional
Arthur
leader.
Rhodes, way to go, sir. Freddie Sanchez, Pat Burrell, Casey Blake. I knew you could do it. Melvin Mora. All right, let's focus on Melvin Mora. You remember Melvin Mora, right, Mike?
Oh, yeah.
An all-time great Met utility player.
Yeah, great catch.
He had
played a lot of positions okay.
Yeah.
He had his moments.
Oriole.
With the Mets and the Orioles. Probably not a Hall of Famer, but he's on the ballot this year. So now
he's on the ballot, so arguably he is Hall of Fame worthy.
What do you guys think is the most statistically noteworthy accomplishment of Melvin Mora's life?
Had an OPS plus of 115 for 3 years in a row.
led the American League in triples three times?
The answer is that he is the father of quintuplets.
Ah.
According to Yahoo News in 2008.
Yes. I remember that. Yeah.
They got mentioned a lot.
The chances of having quintuplets are 1 in 57 million, which is probably like, you know, a little bit more of a stretch than leading the league in triples.
Did he miss a game when his wife delivered the quintuplets?
Great question. I don't know the answer to that. So my friend Dan Ingber sent me a torrent of texts the other day when, A, he found out that Melvin Mora was on the Hall of Fame ballot and was confused. So we had a conversation about the 10-year rule. And B, when he was Googling Melvin Mora, and there was an autocomplete for both Melvin Mora quintuplets and Melvin Mora sextuplets. Mm. So there is a lot of confusion out there, not only about Melvin Mora's presence on the Hall of Fame ballot, but about whether his wife, Giselle, who is the all-star mom at home, according to USA Today, about whether she gave birth to five children or six children. So Dan helpfully sent me this email. Header, evidence for the quintuplet theory, 2002, New York Times. Melvin Mora changes positions as often as he changes his children's diapers, references quintuplets. Mm. That USA Today story, Giselle grew up in Brooklyn, New York as the all-star mom at home. Yahoo News, the chances of having quintuplets are 1 in 57 million. 2009, Baltimore Sun. Genesis plays a mean third base. Matthew wants to be a veterinarian. Christian likes sushi. Jada is a budding gymnast. And Rebecca has a crush on the Orioles' Brian Roberts. Well, that's a quality, I guess. So that's five children.
Good thing it wasn't a crush on Luis Polonia.
God, that's horrible. 2014, video evidence Dan provides of Mora and his quintuplets throwing out the first pitch at an Orioles game. Well, that would seem to be rock solid. But wait, counter evidence for the sextuplet theory. Melvin Mora himself, in a 2006 interview in a book, that book titled 50 Things Every Guy Should Know How to Do, about the expert, chapter 11, How to Care for Children, Melvin Mora is the starting third baseman for the Baltimore Orioles and the father of sextuplets. This written in Melvin Mora's words, having sextuplets means changing a lot of diapers. At first, I didn't know how to do it, so I watched my wife doing it. I saw her holding a baby and changing a diaper, and I knew I had to do it because there was no way she could do it by herself. With six kids, I've had to change as many as 40 diapers in one day. So I'm inclined to think that the authors of 50 Things Every Guy Should Know How to Do, which also features Bernie Kosar, legendary quarterback on How to Throw a Spiral, I feel like maybe Melvin Mora actually didn't say that.
Wait. Bernie Kosar was able to throw a spiral?
This is another claim in this book. Yeah, I feel like maybe Melvin Mora didn't actually say that, or maybe he was so sleep deprived that he didn't actually realize that he only had five children. He does have actually more than five children. He just has quintuplets. So Copley News Service in 2006 wrote a review of the book How to Care for Children, which noted the contribution by Melvin Mora, the father of quintuplets, parenthetical, the book says sextuplets, wrong. So Copley News Service tells us Melvin Mora, quintuplets. If you happen to be Melvin Mora or have any information that suggests that the answer is actually sextuplets, please go to our Facebook page. The word of the year, quintuplets. Or is it sextuplets? We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe to Hang Up and listen on iTunes. You can find us by going to itunes.com/slatepodcasts. When you're there, leave us a comment or a rating and a rating. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Our producer is Mickey Kapper. I think it's Mickey's last show this week. Thank you,
really?
Mickey, for all of your great service over the years. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Steve Lickteig, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.
Melvin Mora returned to the Baltimore Orioles on Monday, 2 days after his wife gave birth to quintuplets during the season. Jesus Christ. No wonder he's not going to make the Hall of Fame.
So 2 days, that's about 9 hours per child. That seems right.